Hello, welcome to the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, October 4. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Dubuque paper today, enrollment rates have colleges optimistic. Officials discuss ongoing challenges with student recruitment and retention for the 2021-22 year. This story by Allie Hinga. After years of declining enrollment, Clark University officials saw cause for optimism this fall. The Dubuque College welcomed 264 new undergraduate students to campus, which officials billed as one of the largest incoming classes in the school's history. While Clark's enrollment is down 14.9% over the past 5 years, enrollment rose 4.5% from last fall to this fall to 888 students. "I think this is a new normal for Clark University," said Charles Cotton III, Vice President for Enrollment Management. "We made sure to work with and afford an opportunity for a collegiate education to those that we believe will be successful here and that we can support." Local colleges this fall saw a mix of enrollment trends, with most reporting declining enrollment over a five-year period, but several reported stable or increased enrollment from last fall to this fall. Local school teachers said they found success with recruitment and retention efforts, though in some ways the ongoing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic and broader demographic shifts continue to impact their work. And that was local school leaders. Compared to the fall of 2016, enrollment this fall is down 6.9% at Loras College, 13.2% at Northeast Iowa Community College, 13.7% at University of Dubuque, 14.9% at Clark, and 23.6% at University of Wisconsin-Platteville. At Southwest Wisconsin Technical College in Fenimore, enrollment rose by 4.9% over those 5 years. Those trends have looked different over the past year, however. Compared to the fall of 2020, enrollment rose by 1.4% at Southwest Tech, by 0.1% at NICC, and 4.5% at Clark, 1.1% at Loras. Enrollment fell from fall 2020 to fall 2021 at UD and UWP by 9.5% and 11.1%, respectively. Cotton attributed this year's growth at Clark to multiple factors, including efforts to recruit transfer students through partnerships with Iowa's community colleges. The school also had success recruiting international students. Southwest Tech spokeswoman Katie Glass said the college was successful in connecting with students who withdrew from classes during the pandemic and by eliminating financial barriers so they could return. More broadly, she also attributed enrollment gains to Southwest Tech's partnerships with businesses and efforts to provide students with the support they need to stay in school. Mary Ellen Carroll, Senior Vice President at Loras, wrote in an email to the Telegraph Herald that the launch of new graduate and certificate programs has helped maintain or boost enrollment along with student financial support efforts. "Going forward, our recruitment goals focus on incremental growth," she wrote. "We aspire to reach an overall enrollment of 1,600 by 2026 while simultaneously maintaining the growing diversity of our student body." Christy Streif, Director of Enrollment Management at NICC, tied the college's five-year enrollment decline to a decreasing adult and high school population across the school's district, among other factors. "Still, NICC has worked to improve intervention efforts to help retain existing students and tuition relief offerings, such as the state's Last Dollar Scholarship Program and grants offered with COVID-19 relief dollars, have helped reduce financial burdens that students face. Tuition relief has been huge for us this past year, and we're creatively looking at how can we maintain that since we have seen the success," Streif said. Leaders at multiple local schools said challenges associated with the COVID-19 pandemic and other demographic factors persist when it comes to enrollment. UWP spokesman Paul Erickson Said college leaders anticipated declining enrollment as the number of high school-age students falls across the Midwest. The pandemic also made connecting with students through in-person campus visits more challenging. We have to continue to find ways to look at different student populations that maybe we haven't reached before. Expanding our footprint to more areas, trying to find innovative programs to reach previously underserved populations that are growing in numbers, Erickson said. UD President Jeffrey Bullock noted that last school year, the university's representatives weren't allowed to physically visit high schools. Widespread retirements of teachers, counselors, and coaches from school districts around the region also interrupted structures that often help connect students with colleges. Bullock said UD is back to visiting high schools and participating in and hosting college fairs, among other enrollment efforts. He said he expects UD to start rebuilding and growing enrollment, but it will take time for higher education to return to normal. Also on the front page, this Biz Buzz Monday article by Elizabeth Kelsey, shop to bring Mexican-style sweets to the area. A new Galena business soon will tempt local palates with Mexican-style sweets and snacks. Galena couple Maria Ayala and Mario Garcia plan to open La Michoacana Imanaja. I probably mispronounced that. Michoacana Imanaja at 110 South Main Street. The site formerly housed Great American Popcorn Company, which recently moved to 115 North Main. The new business, poised to open by the end of October, will feature Mexican ice cream, desserts, and other traditional delicacies. It's like an ice cream parlor, but ice cream with a Mexican style, said Ayala, a native of Veracruz, Mexico. We're going to prepare all the products ourselves here in Galena using fresh products like fresh fruits. La Michoacana is the name of many Mexican ice cream shops in Mexico and the U.S. It is not an official brand, but refers to a loosely connected network of shops, typically family-owned. Although the shops feature similar offerings, each is individually operated, according to Ayala. When you hear the name Michoacana, you immediately think of elotes and esquites, she said. But every Michoacana is unique. The Galena business will indeed offer elotes and esquites, two variations on a Mexican street dish of grilled corn slathered in a spicy, cheesy sauce. The menu will also feature a variety of dessert options, including mini pancakes, tre leche cake, and flan. And of course, patrons will be able to sample a plethora of ice cream flavors, as well as paletas and popsicles and fruity drinks, such as mangonades, a type of Mexican smoothie. Ayala said La Michoacana ice creams rely less on cream than traditional American ice creams, typically utilizing a base of water, milk, and fresh fruit. The taste is different, but good, she said. The second part of the business name, Imanaja, is comprised of the names of the couple's four children, Iraeus, Magali, Natalie, and Julian. La Michoacana Imanaja plans to hire three employees in addition to the Garcia Ayala family. Future customers can track the progress of the business by visiting their Facebook page. Turning now to page two, here are some news in brief articles. First from Cascade. Authorities said a man pulled a handgun on another driver after traveling at a high rate of speed Saturday night in Dubuque County. Mitchell Lukes, age 24, of Epworth, was arrested Saturday in Cascade on charges of intimidation with a dangerous weapon, possession of marijuana, possession of drug paraphernalia, and person ineligible to carry a dangerous weapon. Court documents state that officers from the Dubuque County Sheriff's Department and Epworth and Piasta Police Departments responded at about 5:30 p.m. Saturday to Epworth after receiving a report of a man displaying a firearm to a driver of a vehicle. Jarrett Potterbaum of Dubuque reported that Lukes was traveling at a high rate of speed on US 20 when he cut across the lanes to exit in Epworth. Potterbaum told authorities that Lukes' vehicle nearly struck another vehicle while crossing lanes. Potterbaum followed Lukes into Epworth and told Lukes to drive more carefully. Lukes then pulled out a handgun and displayed it to Potterbaum, according to documents. Epworth police then received a call about a vehicle driving through town at a high rate of speed west on Old Highway Road. Officers stopped Lukes' vehicle at approximately 6 p.m. in Cascade. Lukes told authority that he had two guns and marijuana in the vehicle. Officers with a search warrant discovered a loaded handgun, a loaded AR-style rifle, and ammunition magazines and boxes, and 1 gram of marijuana in the vehicle. Polling hours are set for Tuesday's primary election in Dubuque. The polls will open from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. during the City of Dubuque primary election, Tuesday, October 5. A list of the polling sites can be found online. All mailed ballots must be returned by 8 p.m. Tuesday to the Dubuque County Elections Office at the Dubuque County Courthouse, 720 Central Avenue, in order to be counted, according to a recent law change. The postmark on a mailed ballot is no longer taken into consideration. Two races will be on the ballot, and all City of Dubuque residents can vote in both races. Tim Flynn, Michaela Freeberger, incumbent Rick Jones, and Louis Mihalakis are running for an at-large Dubuque City Council seat. Brad Kavanaugh, Antonino Urba, John Miller, David Resnick, and April White are running for mayor. The top two vote-getters in each race will move on to the November 2 election. And top 10, TH's most read stories of the week. A story about the alleged abuse of a baby was the most read story on TelegraphHerald.com this past week. And then there's a list following of the 10 other most read articles. And this note, a recreational trail in Dubuque will be closed early this week. Alliant Powerline Trail between South Grandview Avenue and Julian Dubuque Drive will be closed from 7 a.m. today to 5 p.m. Tuesday, October 5, for fiber utility construction, according to a press release from the City of Dubuque. The trail is a multiple-use paved asphalt trail that winds through a wooded corridor on a power line easement. And the local Salvation Army received a $10,000 grant. The Dubuque nonprofit has received a donation to assist local residents in need. The 100-plus Women Who Care Dubuque organization has provided a $10,850 grant to the Salvation Army of Dubuque. A press release states that the funds will be used for the Salvation Army's Pathway of Hope program and will help purchase an emergency disaster vehicle. The vehicle will serve a variety of uses, including a newly formed mobile food pantry. Moving to the Tri-State page, page 5, this story by Benjamin Fisher. Local officials cite various factors in vaccination rates. Two of the 10 local counties in the Telegraph Herald coverage area have cleared the 70% threshold of residents 12 and older who are fully vaccinated against COVID-19. But officials in Joe Davies County, Illinois, and Iowa County, Wisconsin, provide different explanations for leading the pack in vaccination rate locally. As of the latest data available Sunday afternoon, 75.6% of Joe Davies County residents 12 and older were fully vaccinated, while Iowa County's rate stood at 72%. Vaccines currently are approved for people 12 and older. The next highest rate in the TH coverage area was Dubuque County, which stood at 67.8%. The lowest local county was Clayton County, Iowa, at 50.6. In Joe Davies County, Public Health Administrator Sandra Schleicher chalked the success up to several factors. She said Joe Davies County tends to skew older than some other counties in the area. A lot of our population is in that older age group, too, who were able to get the vaccine early, she said. referring to the initial prioritization of doses going to those 65 and older. A bigger percentage went out and got their shot right away. Schleicher also said leaders in Joe Davies County, from all ends of the ideological spectrum, were quick to publicly support and announce they were getting vaccinated as well. Her department also launched an aggressive public message campaign right away. "I think there was a lot of interest at the beginning," she said. "We were also able to work with a lot of partners in the county to get that message out there and administer a lot of doses." In Iowa County, Emergency Management Director Keith Hurlburt said some of its early success related to the county's geographic location. "Iowa County has a unique geographical location relationship with Dane County, home to Madison, where it might have been easier at first to get access to the vaccine," he said. "We have a fair amount of our workforce who travels to Dane County every day. That helped." Hurlburt said Iowa County residents also just were quick to follow public health recommendations. Iowa County's approach was to hit really hard with messaging, using social media and the internet, never turning down an interview, have a constant presence out there, he said. "We have just had a lot of success getting our people on board. Many, many more people that wore masks, social distance, and did all the right things." An examination of zip code level data from the Illinois Department of Public Health and Wisconsin Department of Health Services show large vaccination ranges even inside Joe Davies and Iowa counties. In Joe Davies County, Galena and the surrounding area has a far higher vaccination rate than East Dubuque, for example. In Iowa County, the closer in area is to Madison, the higher the rate. And from the Manchester Press, also on the Tri-State page, "Group that saved Manchester Theater honors its first president." The group Friends of the Castle Theater in Manchester recently named its auditorium in honor of Al Remling, who died in May. "We know how important Mr. Remling was to the continued operation of the Castle Theater as a community-owned movie theater, and the board of directors thought it was important to recognize that," said Zach Schmidt, current president of Friends of the Castle. Remling was elected president by the board at its first meeting after the incorporation of the theater as a nonprofit in September of 2009, and he served 6 years in that role. Jack Klaus and Dwayne Tiemens spurred the incorporation after Bob Fridley, president of Fridley Theaters, called Klaus to say he would be closing the theater unless someone was willing to put together a nonprofit group to whom he could sell it. Dwayne and I, along with a group of volunteers, spent a lot of time looking at other nonprofit theaters and working out how we could make it work if people with experience like the Fridleys couldn't, Klaus explained. "Once we worked our way through that, we knew we needed to find a charismatic leader who would be able to get people to work together and be willing to put forth the effort to guide the theater through those early years. I don't know quite how or who got Al involved, but suddenly he was part of our group and it was apparent he had the skills we needed." Fridley eventually sold the theater to the group for $1. Soon, volunteers stepped up to deep clean every part of the theater, do remodeling, and make decisions about saving the marquee. Some learned how to run the projector, and many donated money. The group also received support from the Knights of Pythias, who owned the building. Al's favorite saying was, "We turned the lights on in downtown Manchester." The whole thing came together under Al's and the committee's leadership, Klaus said. Klaus believes Remling was responsible for a new surround sound system in the theater. "He thought that should be our next project, but we didn't have any spare money," Klaus said. Suddenly, Al announced that an anonymous donor had contributed the $14,000 needed for the sound system. Al would never tell us who the donor was, but in my mind, I always suspected it was Al himself. Turning over now to page 15 in the Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin news, in brief, this column from Wheaton, Illinois: kennel operator convicted in 2019 fire that killed 29 dogs. the operator of a suburban Chicago kennel where 29 dogs were killed in a 2019 fire, has been convicted of charges of animal cruelty and violation of owner's duties. After a five-day bench trial, a DuPage County judge found Garrett Mercado, 32, guilty Friday of 3 counts of animal cruelty, 6 counts of violation of owner's duties, the Daily Herald reported. All the charges he was convicted of are misdemeanors. Mercado will be sentenced on October 22. Judge Miller's ruling verifies that we have said what we have said all along, said Garrett Mercado, completely disregarded the health and safety of numerous dogs in his care, DuPage County State's Attorney Robert Berlin said following the verdict. Prosecutors said Mercado left the Bully Life Animal Services Kennel in DuPage County, just outside West Chicago, unattended for about 5 hours on January 14, 2019. During his absence, a fire broke out in the kennel, killing 29 dogs, which were trapped in cages in the small two-story building. And in East Peoria, a man suspected of shoplifting falls into the Illinois River and dies. A central Illinois man suspected of shoplifting died after he fell into the Illinois River while apparently trying to hide near a U.S. Coast Guard station, authorities said. The man died Friday after it appears he scaled a fence and tumbled down an embankment into the river in East Peoria, Fond du Lac Park District Police Chief Michael Johnson said on Saturday. Tazewell County Coroner Charles Hanley said the man was a 31-year-old Peoria resident. His name and cause of death were not released, pending an autopsy set for today, the Journal Star reported. Johnson said the man was suspected of shoplifting from a nearby Walmart store, and he apparently ran from the store and attempted to hide near the Coast Guard station in East Peoria, in an area where the embankment is nothing but solid rock and pretty steep. It looked like he kind of stumbled on the rocks, and once he hit the water, instead of trying to get back to the shoreline, he tried to get to the dock in the harbor, the chief said. He got about halfway, started to sink, and couldn't get back up. Authorities said the area where the man entered the river is several feet deep. The Fond du Lac Marine Unit recovered the man's body along with a neck brace he had been wearing. And this story from Milwaukee, 11-year-old girl fatally shot and a 5-year-old injured. An 11-year-old girl has died and a 5-year-old injured in a shooting in Milwaukee, according to police. According to authorities, the girls were in a car with family members about 9 p.m. Saturday when another vehicle approached and gunshots were fired, striking the children. The family drove to a nearby police station where officers performed first aid until paramedics arrived and the children were transported to the hospital. The older girl suffered fatal injuries and the younger is in stable condition. Police have not yet made an arrest in the case. At least 4 other minors have been shot since Friday in Milwaukee. And this last story from the town of Middleton, Wisconsin. 3 people have died in a fiery crash in Dane County, sheriff's officials said Sunday. A preliminary investigation shows an eastbound vehicle struck another vehicle from behind in the town of Middleton Saturday about 10:15 p.m. The impact sent the vehicle that was struck into a farm field where it became engulfed in flames. Authorities said the 3 occupants in that vehicle were pronounced dead at the scene. The other vehicle ended up in the ditch. The driver, the sole occupant, was taken to the hospital with serious injuries that are not believed to be life-threatening. Turning now to the opinion page, do politicians deserve statues? This is by Scott Reeder for the Telegraph Herald. Politicians are peculiar creatures. They name parks, highways, airports, and just about anything else that's paid for by us after themselves. And if a politician rises high enough, a statue will be erected in the person's honor. Statues are designed to be permanent, but politicians' reputations are much more fluid. 6 years ago, then Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan was pushing to erect a statue on the Illinois Capitol grounds of former U.S. Speaker of the House Dennis Hastert. Hastert said thanks, but no thanks. Unforeseen modesty on the part of a retired pole? Nope. At the point Hastert declined the honor, he knew he was under investigation by the feds for sexually abusing students when he was a high school coach and funneling hush money to one of them to keep the allegations quiet. He eventually pleaded guilty to a financial crime and was sentenced to 15 months in prison. In fairness to Madigan, he had no idea of any problems when he recommended the honor, but if you think that political pratfall will discourage other Illinois lawmakers from recommending politicians for statues, think again. Today, there is a proposal pending to place a Ronald Reagan statue on the grounds of the Illinois Capitol. Is he worthy? Well, more worthy than some, but less so than others. Back in 1984, I voted for Reagan, but I don't want a cent of taxpayer dollars to go toward honoring him or any other politician. Isn't having been elected to public office distinction enough? Statues have little to do with history and much to do with glorification. Yesterday's heroes might be tomorrow's scoundrels. For example, 103 years ago, a statue of Stephen Douglas was erected on the Illinois Capitol lawn. He was a U.S. senator and the arch rival of Abraham Lincoln. More recently, critics pointed out he was a slave owner and a political impediment to emancipation. So, last year, his statue was removed. We have had so much trouble with statehouse statues, one can't help but wonder if the land of Lincoln has an edifice complex. The political class exists for its own benefit, and politicians like to venerate one another. Interestingly enough, personal dishonesty or political graft has never been sufficient cause for a politician's image to be removed from the Illinois Capitol. On the statehouse's second floor, you'll find portraits of Otto Kerner, Dan Walker, and George Ryan. All served as governor, and all ended up in prison. After impeaching Governor Rod Blagojevich, lawmakers passed legislation forbidding public funding of portraits of governors removed from office. They really hated that Blago. It's the only time I can think of such action being taken. In fact, when the lawmakers passed that resolution, there was so much vitriol during the debate that I couldn't help but think of a scene from Cecil B. DeMille's The Ten Commandments when Pharaoh said, "Let the name of Moses be stricken from every book and tablet, stricken from every pylon and obelisk in Egypt. Let the name of Moses be unheard and unspoken, erased from the memory of man for all time." But obviously they didn't learn their lesson because there are plenty of other paintings and statues honoring political scoundrels in that building. One of my favorites was a painting of former Illinois Secretary of State and Speaker of the House, Paul Powell. Powell's motto supposedly was, quote, "There's only one thing worse than a defeated politician, and that's a broke one," end quote. When Powell died in 1970, more than $800,000 was found stuffed in shoeboxes in the closet of his Springfield hotel room. That would be about $5.6 million in today's money. And Paul Powell never drew a salary greater than $30,000. Powell's portrait used to hang in the visitors' gallery of the Illinois House. Whenever I'd walk by it, I liked to give the picture frame a nudge. Like so many Illinois politicians, he deserves to be remembered the way he was, crooked. And that, again, is the Telegraph Herald's own editorial by Scott Reeder. You are listening to a reading of the Telegraph Herald today on IRIS. Today is Monday, October 4. Now we turn to today's obituaries, just two in the paper today. First from Cascade, Iowa, James P. Clemens, Sr., age 85, passed away Wednesday, September 29 at Unity Point Finley Hospital in Dubuque. Visitation will be from 9 to 11 Wednesday, October 6th at the Reef Funeral Home in Cascade, followed by services at Holy Family Catholic Church, New Mallory, Piasta, with Reverend Mark Osterhaus presiding. Concelebrating will be Reverend Rodney Ehlers. Burial will be at the Holy Family Cemetery with full military honors by the Cascade American Legion Post No. 528. Jim was born March 2, 1936, in Dubuque, son of Clarence and Anna Redding Clemon. He received his education in the Piasta area schools. On June 18, 1960, he was united in marriage to Vivian Harney at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Iowa City. She preceded him in death on June 4, 2003. Jim was retired following 30-plus years with John Deere Dubuque Works. He loved hunting, fishing, gardening, and scrapping metal, and especially enjoyed time with family and friends. From Platteville, Wisconsin, Ada E. Osterholtz, age 102, died Friday, October 1. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. today at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, where there will be a parish rosary at 7 p.m. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, October 5, at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Platteville. Burial will be in Calvary Cemetery in Platteville. And funeral services for today, William J. Busson of Montfort, Wisconsin. Visitation 10 a.m. to noon, the Bethany Alliance Church, Fenimore, Wisconsin. The memorial service is noon today at the church. Reva Doty from Savannah, Illinois. The graveside service is 10 a.m. Saturday, October 9, Savannah Township Cemetery. Celebration of Life, 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Saturday at Manny's Pizza in Savannah. From Dubuque, Jeffrey J. Fallhaber. Visitation 3 to 7 on Tuesday, October 5, with a wake service at 2:45. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory is in charge. Mass of Christian burial, 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, October 6th, at St. Joseph Church, Key West. And also in Dubuque, Ruth M. Green. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today, the Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory. Mass of Christian burial at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, October 5, St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. In Cascade, Ronald G. Manternock. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. today at St. Matthias Catholic Church in Cascade. Mass of Christian burial 11 a.m. today at the church. From Dubuque, Donald J. Nauman. Visitation 10:45 today at the Saints Peter and Paul Catholic Church in Sherrill, Iowa. Mass of Christian burial 11 a.m. today at the church. Also, the following all from Dubuque, Gerald F. Pickle. Visitation 10 to 11, Saturday, October 9, at Holy Ghost Church. Memorial Mass at 11 a.m. Saturday at the church. Mildred E. Russell. Visitation 3 to 5, Monday, October 11, at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory. Service is at 5 p.m. October 11 at the funeral home. And Alfred J. Timmerman. Visitation from 3:30 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, October 6th, Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory. Mass is at 11 a.m. Thursday, October 7th at St. Joseph the Worker Catholic Church. Moving now to the sports page, unbeaten Hawkeyes move up to the number 3 in the AP poll. Iowa's gearing up for its biggest home game since the 1980s. Cincinnati has its highest ranking in 12 years, and Clemson is on the outside looking in at the AP college football poll for the first time since 2014. Alabama and Georgia are the only constants during this topsy-turvy college football season. They held down the top two spots for a fifth straight week in the AP Top 25. Alabama received 53 of a possible 62 first-place votes Sunday, with Georgia picking up the rest. After those two teams, the movement up and down, in and out of the top 25 was about what would be expected after a week in which 9 ranked teams lost, including 4 in the top 10. Through the first 5 weeks of the season, 34 ranked teams have lost, the most in poll history. Iowa leapfrogged Penn State to take the number 3 spot after its 51-14 road win over previously unbeaten Maryland. The Hawkeyes have their highest ranking since 2015. Penn State beat Indiana 24-0 at home and remained number 4. Number 5 Cincinnati, coming off a 24-13 road win over Notre Dame, has its best ranking since Brian Kelly's 2009 Bearcats were number 4 in the first week of November. Oklahoma, Ohio State, Oregon, Michigan, and BYU round out the top 10. And in the local calendar today, men's college golf, Loris is at Central Fall Classic at Finkbine Golf Course in Iowa City. Clark is at the Heart of America Conference Preview at the golf course at Creekmoor, Raymore, Missouri. And women's college golf, Clark is at Heart of America Conference Preview at the golf course at Creekmoor in Raymore, Missouri. Turning to page 7, the lifestyle and health page, the article today for the Telegraph Herald is What is the Flu? This story by Bobby Conneru. I was diagnosed with low-risk disease. If I decide to get treatment, how do I decide which treatment is best for me? Is one better than the other? That is a continuation of the article on prostate cancer. I'll pick that up after I get through with the flu story, which is submitted by Laurel Kelly from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Fever, upset stomach, diarrhea, sore throat, chills, coughing, sneezing, and headache all can make you feel miserable. And when you're not feeling well, it sometimes can be hard to know exactly what's wrong and how you can help yourself feel better. With flu season approaching, this is a good time to look at the symptoms of what is and is not the flu. A runny or stuffy nose, sneezing, congestion, headache, and sore throat likely herald the common cold. This viral infection of your nose and throat usually is harmless, although it might not feel that way. While there is no cure for the common cold, most people get better without treatment, usually within a week to 10 days. Antibiotics aren't effective against viruses, and overusing them can contribute to the development of antibiotic-resistant strains of bacteria. Lifestyle and home remedies for symptom relief include plenty of fluids and rest. There are pros and cons to commonly used cold remedies, such as over-the-counter pain relievers, decongestants, nasal sprays, and cough syrups. What many people call the flu is actually viral gastroenteritis, or stomach flu. Characteristic symptoms include diarrhea, nausea, and abdominal cramps and pain. Symptoms usually last just a day or two, but occasionally they might persist as long as 10 days. There's often no specific medical treatment for viral gastroenteritis. Self-care measures can help with symptom relief, though. Get plenty of rest and let your stomach settle by avoiding solid food for a few hours. Instead, suck on ice chips or take small sips of water, then ease back into eating with a bland diet. If nausea returns, stop eating again. Avoid foods like dairy products, caffeine, and fatty or highly seasoned foods until you feel better. Influenza is the true flu. It's a viral infection that attacks your respiratory system, including your nose, throat, and lungs. At first, the flu might seem like a common cold with a runny nose, sneezing, and sore throat. But colds usually develop slowly, whereas the flu tends to come on suddenly. And although a cold can be a bother, you usually feel much worse with the flu. For most people, the flu resolves on its own, but sometimes the flu and its complications can be deadly. People at higher risk of developing flu complications include young children, pregnant women, and those 2 weeks postpartum, people older than 65, people with weakened immune systems, and some chronic illnesses, and people who are obese. Usually, you'll need nothing more than rest and plenty of fluids to treat the flu. But if you have a severe infection or are at higher risk of complications, your healthcare provider might prescribe an antiviral drug to treat the flu. Unlike the common cold and stomach flu, there is a vaccine for the flu. While it's not 100% effective, getting vaccinated for the flu can reduce your risk of becoming infected and the flu and lessen its severity and lower your risk of hospitalizations if you are. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends a yearly flu vaccine for anyone 6 months and older, with rare exceptions. Vaccination is your best defense against the flu. And again, that article was a reprint from the Mayo Clinic News. And from the health column now, this by Bobby Conneru, Prostate Cancer 101, Frequently Asked Questions, Part 2. I was diagnosed with low-risk disease. If I decide to get treatments, how do I decide which treatment is best for me? Is one better than the other? This is a complicated answer and can lead to anxiety for many patients. Deciding between surgery and radiation therapy can be a difficult choice. The efficacy and cure rates from both are similar. The difference lies in the side effects. First, let's talk about the treatment options in more detail. The goal of radiation therapy for men with localized prostate cancer is to deliver a therapeutic dose of radiation to the tumor while minimizing radiation to normal tissue. Both external beam radiation therapy and brachytherapy are widely used as a single modality for clinically localized low-risk prostate cancer. When used as the primary treatment modality, results with radiation therapy are similar to those with radical prostatectomy. External beam radiation therapy uses a machine called a linear accelerator to deliver radiation to treat the prostate gland and a margin of adjacent normal tissue. Complications have significantly decreased and are low with modern advancements in radiation planning and delivery with techniques such as intensity-modulated radiation therapy and image-guided radiation therapy. External beam radiation therapy generally is used alone for low-risk, clinically localized prostate cancer. The article goes on to answer questions about different modalities of treatment. And in conclusion, one of the most recent advancements in the specialty is the ability to create separation between organs to further reduce radiation doses. A new hydrogel called Spacer OAR has been developed. It can be inserted between the prostate and the rectum and slowly dissolves during a period of 3 months. The spacer allows us to create a separation. This reduces radiation doses by 50% to the rectum. I recently used this spacer in one of my patients receiving stereotactic body radiation. The hydrogel displaced the portion away from the prostate and the radiation doses encompassed the prostate while avoiding the area below. Because of these advancements, we can deliver radiation therapy faster, more accurately, and with fewer side effects. Conneru is a board-certified radiation oncologist. He did his training at Northwestern University in Chicago. He is an adjunct assistant professor at Loyola University, Chicago. He lives in Dubuque and specializes in treating cancers of the prostate, breast, lung, and brain. To schedule a consultation, you can call 815-599-7000. From the Almanac today, today is Monday, October 4, the 277th day of 2021. There are 88 days left in the year. And here are some historical notes. In 1861, during the Civil War, the United States Navy authorized construction of the first ironclad ship, the USS Monitor. In 1957, the space age began as the Soviet Union launched Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite into orbit. In 1970, rock singer Janis Joplin, 27, was found dead in her Hollywood hotel room. In 1976, Secretary of Agriculture Earl Butz resigned in the wake of a controversy over an obscene joke he'd made that was derogatory to black people. In 1991, 26 nations, including the United States, signed the Madrid Protocol, which imposed a 50-year ban on oil exploration and mining in Antarctica. In 2010, the Supreme Court began a new era with three women serving together for the first time as Elena Kagan took her place at the end of the bench. And in 2019, Diane Carroll died in Los Angeles at the age of 84 after a bout with breast cancer. She'd been the first Black woman to star as a non-servant in her own TV series, Julia, which ran from 1968 to 1973. Back to page 2 in the Dubuque section. After life-threatening battle with sepsis, a local woman's trying to raise awareness. The illness, an extreme response by the body to an infection, accounts for about one-third of U.S. hospital deaths. This by Olivia Garrett. 4 years ago, a serious case of sepsis threatened Vicki Shigfree's life. Today, the Dubuque native wants others to be aware of the dangers of the illness. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, 1.7 million adults develop sepsis each year, and nearly 270,000 die in the U.S. That accounts for about one-third of hospital deaths, although in 87% of the cases, the infection started outside the hospital. In February 2017, Shigfree experienced flu-like symptoms that didn't abate and prompted several emergency room visits. As her symptoms worsened over the course of a week, she was airlifted to Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, where she spent most of the next 3 months fighting for her life through 10 surgeries and a 3-week coma. "It was very close to being too late when she landed up there," said her husband, Kelly Erickson. Shigfree eventually was diagnosed with sepsis, an extreme response to an infection. Before her illness, many of her family and friends had never heard of sepsis. "People need to be more aware," she said. "It can begin in the lung, urinary tract, skin, or gastrointestinal tract, a response to anything from a traumatic injury to a fungal infection." Her sepsis wasn't diagnosed during her first emergency room visit. She still doesn't know what caused it, though doctors told her bacteria must have entered her body through a break in the skin. "If she'd had a blood test early on, things might have been a lot different," Erickson said. She felt too sick to get up and watch the Super Bowl and complained of extreme body pain. Concerned, Erickson called her parents. "We were in Florida, and he called and said, 'You can't touch her anywhere. She just screams,'" recalled her father. "I said, 'Call an ambulance.' She was taken to a Dubuque hospital where, due to the severity of the illness, they recommend she be transferred to another hospital," Erickson said. The Shigfree family had experience with Mayo Clinic, so they chose to send her there. Ed and Joan, her parents, rushed to Minnesota. Erickson came too, and the three camped out at a hotel across from the hospital. Her family has clear memories of that time, but for Vicki, the details are blurry. In addition to the coma, her illness and medications left her in a haze of gruesome dreams, unsure of what was real. "I was asleep so much," she said. "The dreams that I was having that I thought were happening were just the worst nightmares." Real life wasn't much comfort. The infection spread into her bones. Surgery was a revolving door, Ed said. They'd take care of the most severe things first, and then three more would pop up. It seemed like she was going into surgery every other day. For a while, she was on the liver transplant list. On May 30, she improved enough that she was told a transplant wouldn't be necessary. Erickson keeps a copy of the letter on the refrigerator to this day. After a round of physical therapy at Mayo, she came back to Manor Care Health Service in Dubuque for more therapy. It was months before she was able to teach herself how to walk again. Years later, she still can't walk as far or as fast as she could before getting sick. She still takes 27 medications and supplements each day. "I wasn't much of a pharmacist before this happened, but I certainly am now," Erickson said. Local hospitals see hundreds of cases of sepsis each year. "When we have people come into the hospital, one of the first things we ask them is, 'Do they have an infection?'" said Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital infection preventionist Pat Lemkuhl. "Patients don't always know what an infection looks like, so doctors ask about common symptoms as well. Symptoms include fever, chills, rapid breathing and heart rate, rash, confusion, and disorientation. If you get to the point where you're having these symptoms and it's related to sepsis, you need medical care, Lemkill said. When it comes to prevention, the CDC recommends preventing infections by taking care of chronic conditions and keeping up with vaccinations, keeping cuts clean and covered until healed, hand washing, and seeking medical care immediately if an infection doesn't get better. The most important thing is don't ignore wounds that are not healing on their own, said Mercy One Dubuque Medical Center infection specialist Gail Gates. And pictured on the page 2 with the article is a photo of Vicky, who suffered sepsis, a life-threatening complication in 2017. Weather today, partly sunny, looking for a high of 70 and a low of 57. Wind out of the north, northeast at 6 to 12. Partly sunny and pleasant tomorrow with a high of 72 and a low of 56. Look for some low clouds and mostly cloudy and perhaps a rain shower following that on Wednesday and Thursday. Dubuque, your normal high is 74 and your normal low is 61. The record high of 90 degrees was set in 1997, and the record low, 27 degrees, was set in 1987. We had a trace of precipitation in the last 24 hours. Month to date is 0.22 inches. Normally, 0.33 would be received by today. The year-to-date rainfall total is 23.32, a little behind the normal for the year-to-date, which is typically 31.59. About a moderate pollen index today and a pretty low count on the UV scale. We'll finish up today's broadcast with a return to the front page with a photo of a couple that found a match on a blind date. This story by Olivia Garrett. 6 decades ago, Terry Fortman and Ida Brenner met because of a friend who needed some backup. We went on a blind date together, and 60 years later, here we are, Terry said. A friend of Terry's wanted to go out with a friend of Ida's, but he didn't want to go alone. The four went to the Grand Opera House, then a movie theater, and watched the historical romance Raintree County. After the movie, they went to Ida's friend's house to play games. Daughter Beth Ann Ofstein recalled that when her father tells stories of that night, he says he knew immediately that he wanted to marry Ida someday. 16-year-old Ida had been casually dating another boy before the blind date. Terry, then 17, had just broken up with another girl. My father said, "You can't date two boys. You have to decide on one," Ida recalled. "Of course, I decided on Terry." Personality was the deciding factor. Terry was always happy, Ida said. 3 years later, around Christmas time, Terry asked Ida to marry him, wrapping the ring in a box. They held the wedding on September 9, 1961, at Nativity Catholic Church. Except for 3 years when the family moved to Bluegrass, Iowa, the Fortmans stayed in Dubuque ever since. In the beginning, Ida worked for a couple years, serving lunch at Washington Junior High, and stayed home with their 3 children, Christy Fortman-Doser, Beth Ann, and Keith Fortman. "My son comes home one night and he says, 'Why don't you work, Mom? Other moms work,'" Ida recalled. Terry and Ida laugh about it. As a stay-at-home mother, Ida was doing quite a bit of work at home. But his comment did give Ida an idea and reminded her of a career day in which she participated years earlier. Ida became a teller at Dubuque Savings and Loan Association, working her way up to personal banker and supervisor. She worked full-time for 20 years and then another 5 years part-time as a teller. Ida has shared her financial gifts at church. In 1964, she was a founding member of the Women's Recreation Association, played volleyball, and served as the group's first treasurer. For 22 years, Terry worked for department stores, including Roshek Brothers and Stampfer's. After that, he went into real estate. Terry was a broker owner of Dubuque Partners Real Estate Company. Terry was a golfer and a member of Dubuque Board of Realtors, Dubuque Noon Optimists, and Knights of Columbus. In 1988, all three of the Fortman children were married in the same busy year. We refer to it as the year of the wedding, Terry said. The Fortmans now have 7 grandchildren. They made time for each other, Ofstein said. You can really tell they are very much in love with each other, and it's very evident in how they are still together. That does it for the reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for today, Monday, October 4. You can access a recording of today's reading on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Thanks for listening today. Have a great, safe day.